Money Doesn't Talk. Kaput Radio does. This is a double feature extra length show with two titles. First, Tiny American Dreams, followed by Honey, You Shrunk the Euro. More talk later.
What the heck is this?
And while at midnight on August 2nd, we don't all turn into pumpkins, we do, as a country, lose our borrowing authority for the first time in our history. And that would be a very bad thing. There is no escaping that. There are no off-ramps. People keep looking for off-ramps. They don't exist.
What about this legislation is so offensive that you'd rather see the nation default on its obligations than have the president sign it into law?
Hold the line!
The president said call your congressmen and senators. But when you call them, tell them to hold the line. Tell them we've got to balance our budget.
Armageddon happens at midnight, August 3 is not simply the case, it is not true.
Raise the debt ceiling, raise the debt ceiling. $14 trillion in debt, but yo, we ain't got no crime. Drop $100 bills.
Now the alarm bells are ringing.
It's a dangerous game that we've never played before, and we can't afford to play it now. We can't allow the American people to become collateral damage to Washington's political warfare.
What's on the table right now is an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment to every working person in this country.
But some radical politicians are not looking out for the nation. They're looking out for themselves.
Warning that a default or credit downgrade would be a tremendous blow to the economy.
All right, what are we going to tell the senator? What are we going to do?
Hold the line.
Hold the line. That's what we're going to do.
With a fragile economy that we have, the last thing we need to do is be playing around with August the 2nd and the unknown.
I cannot. I am committed to not raising the debt ceiling.
Time is running out, and there's much at stake if the U.S. defaults on its $14 trillion debt.
A very, very, very serious event, not for the United States alone, but for the global economy at large, because the consequences would be far-reaching.
But I think the real issue here is that the dollar is political power as well as economic power for the United States. And I think that its ability to control not just the financial system, the international financial system, but the international political system will be seriously reduced.
You start a new house loan.
So what does that mean for us?
To keep customers happy.
So they should.
Banking reforms, authorized by the Australian government, Canberra.
Banks introduce a 75-cent surcharge for using the word bank. This is Doyle Redland reporting. Executives from the nation's 50 largest banks announced today that effective immediately, all customers will be assessed a 75-cent surcharge each time they use the word bank. Kenneth Norland is president of the American Banking Association.
Now, each time a customer uses the word bank, in either its spoken or written form, 75 cents will automatically be deducted from his or her account. For instance, if you say, I bank with Bank of America, that would cost you $1.50.
Norland added that customers who use the alternate phrase financial institution can avoid the surcharge as well as the 12-cent transaction fee.
Take, say, health insurance. I mean, you know, most people believe it's just a right. The idea that health care should be determined by wealth, not need, is so profoundly immoral that I'm sure if you can approach people and talk about it seriously, they'll agree. Now, there is an ideology which has been drilled into people for 50 years of intense propaganda by the business classes. We have a highly class-conscious business class. They are deeply imbued with Marxist conceptions. They're vulgar Marxists fighting a bitter class war. They have to be on the other side, but that's their conception. And you have to control the mass of the population with concepts that will be self-destructive for them and beneficial to us. They're totalitarian institutions, pretty much unaccountable to the public, and they do what they like, and there's nothing much you can do about it. On the other hand, if there's a government program, you can influence what it does. But a conception has been created by massive propaganda campaigns that it's the government that's the enemy, not the private corporations. Although they're a far worse enemy, and the government is one of the few ways of protecting people from them. But if we haven't gotten that across, it's our fault.
You know, like, what do you do when you grow up? And he said, well, you know, financial services. And I said, oh, because those have been in the news lately. And I said, how does that work? And he said, well, there's 2,000 physicists on Wall Street now, and I'm one of them. And I said, well, so what's the black box for Wall Street? And he said, well, it's funny that you asked that, because it's actually called black box trading. And it's also sometimes called algo trading, algorithmic trading. And algorithmic trading evolved in part because institutional traders have the same problems that the United States Air Force had, which is that they're moving these positions, whether it's Procter & Gamble or Accenture or whatever, they're moving like a million shares of something through the market. And if they do that all at once, it's like playing poker and just going all in right away, right? You just tip your hand. And so they have to find a way, and they use algorithms to do this, to break up that big thing into a million little transactions. And the magic and the horror of that is that the same math that you use to break up the big thing into a million little things can be used to find a million little things and sew them back together and figure out what's actually happening in the market. So if you need to have some image of what's happening in the stock market right now, what you can picture is a bunch of algorithms that are basically programmed to hide and a bunch of algorithms that are programmed to go find them and act. And all of that's great and it's fine, and that's 70% of the United States stock market, 70% of the operating system formerly known as your pension, your mortgage. And what could go wrong, right? What could go wrong is that a year ago, 9% of the entire market just disappears in 5 minutes, and they called it the flash crash of 245, right? All of a sudden, 9% just goes away, and nobody to this day can even agree on what happened, because nobody ordered it, nobody asked for it, nobody had any control over what was actually happening. All they had was just a monitor in front of them that had the numbers on it and just a red button that said, stop. And that's the thing, right, is that we're writing things. We're writing these things that we can no longer read. And it's we've rendered something kind of illegible. And we've lost the sense of what's actually happening in this world that we've made.
Congress is spotted walking out of a gay nightclub. And now your medically induced recap of this week's news. The debate in Congress rages on as to whether or not they should wreck the nation's economy.
Thanks for your time tonight.
It's very good to be with you. My pleasure. Good evening.
I understand you're an economist.
I am an economist, yes, indeed.
Right. Do you understand the euro?
No, I'm an economist. No, you want religious questions, Brian. You've got to go and get somebody appropriately qualified. I'm an economist.
Can you explain to us, then, the Greek economy?
Oh, look, Brian, better value elsewhere, I think. I mean, I wouldn't...
Value elsewhere, what do you mean?
No, I wouldn't touch it with a pole, Brian. Don't put your money in there.
No, I don't want to invest in it. I'm just asking you to describe
it. Oh, you're seeking information
about information
the nature
about
of
it.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
Because there's a great amount of nervousness, isn't there?
Oh, there certainly is, Brian. And they have, let's face it, very serious structural problems with the Greek economy.
They're broke.
They would be if things improved out of sight, Brian. I think the problem's actually worse than that at the moment.
And they've received a bailout from the other European economies.
Yes, mainly France and Germany.
Yes, why France and Germany exactly?
Well, they work. They're successful economies, Brian.
Because the first bailout didn't touch the sides, did it, really?
Well, they do have some serious structural problems, and that needs to be addressed.
And what are they?
Well, they can't pay their debts, Brian. I mean, Greece owes 160% of what it produces. I mean, the task is a Sisyphean task. It's rolling a rock up a mountain.
Mm. So Greece is insolvent.
Brian, put it this way. If it were a private company, there'd be a fire there on Saturday at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right. So how big was the bailout?
First bailout was $100 billion.
Second bailout?
$100 billion again, Brian.
And how long will that last them?
I think there's some confidence that'll get them to Tuesday, Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. So what is the alternative to bailing them out?
Well, not bailing them out would probably force them out the bottom of the EU. And, of course, the strength of the EU is precisely the unity provided, the capacity those countries have to help one another.
But don't they weaken themselves by doing that?
They do. That's a very good point. And the novelty of giving Greece $100 billion every fortnight is going to wear off at some point.
Well, the Greeks don't want austerity measures, obviously.
They don't, no. And, of course, they would need to be complicit in a solution. They'd need to make it work.
But why would anyone want to invest in an economy that can't pay its debts?
Good question. But people have been doing it for 20 years. That's why the problem exists, Brian.
And whatever else they sort out, that might have to apply to some of the other European economies.
That's right. Sorry, Brian. Getting a text. Sorry.
What's that?
Would we like to buy Portugal?
Buy Portugal.
Anybody want to buy Portugal? Yeah. Portugal's for sale.
How much?
Oh, they won't need money. We just need to guarantee the debt. Oh, hello. Having a special, red spot special. If we do it today, we can have Ireland as well.
Oh, really? How much for both?
How much have you got? Has anyone got a hat? We might have a crack at this. Ireland's nice.
It is good, isn't it?
Yeah, summer.
Congress today passed a landmark Social Security reform bill they estimate could save the troubled program billions by encouraging Americans to live faster and die younger. The so-called Grab Life by the Balls bill includes provisions to cut the cost of cigarettes in half, outlaws helmets, and adjusts the CDC's recommended amount of sleep from 8 hours a night to when you're dead.
The most effective way to stem our out-of-control Social Security budget is for all Americans to go out early in a blaze of glory.
The bill's long-term initiatives, like repealing all gun laws and replacing train crossing warnings with signs encouraging motorists to speed up, are expected to save Americans millions annually by gradually reducing their average lifespan by 15 to 20 years. The bill's short-term initiatives aim to immediately cut current Social Security costs in half by replacing senior citizens' monthly checks with vouchers for grain alcohol, back alley tattoos, and extreme sports.
I got this coupon to motocross over a canyon. Better do my part to help the deficit.
But some critics are not convinced the bill will be enough to save the program from bankruptcy.
We need a much more aggressive policy here, like my proposal to require all commercial airlines to do a barrel roll while coming in for a landing.
Are you kidding me? We need to privatize. The government has no right telling me who to raw dog and what to explode.
Supporters in Congress say the cost will be offset by the so-called pussy tax on products such as sweaters, vegetables, hand soap, and flu shots.
America, would you rather die old, broke and forgotten, or die a motherfucking legend?
The new program follows in the footsteps of the Life is a Cartoon Medicare campaign, which encourages seniors to run full speed off of cliffs and smoke sticks of dynamite. Moving on, KFC has unveiled a new line of boneless employees.
What actually is a debt ceiling? Another circular conversation? Hi, my name's Martin. I'm not produced this show. Coming in pretty late, I admit, but I thought I'd get you interested first. Well, a debt ceiling is, of course, a silly pretense. In the present monetary system, there is no ceiling possible unless you want to let your economy die and thereby committing slow, painful suicide. What we really need is an irrationality ceiling for the wacky people in government, industry, and media. But Let's not split hairs over economic nonsense like capitalism. Where's the capital in capitalism? Even Karl Marx would have scratched his head if he lived today. There is only costly hired finance, an ephemeral commodity you can't keep, unreliable, instable, and its only purpose, obtaining elusive profits. So let's call the system rather profitism, since everyone needs profit money as the only means to have access to goods and services. And money in your pocket is a liability in someone else's pocket, let's not forget. By the way, thin air is not useful for creating money. Only assets of one kind or another can be used to create a currency. I like to remind ourselves of that sometimes regarding populist wackiness about the matter. Assets are not thin air, but the real world used as the vehicle, with poverty, lethal conflict, and environmental damage as the undesirable byproducts of this profit process. Another little idea. Everyone is forced to participate. Moralizing, blaming, finger-pointing seems silly, and it does not help a better understanding. Understanding what exactly? Another circular conversation? No way, Jose. Instead, I'd like to convince you that the present confusion and inability in financial circles is an honest reflection of having no answers to the inherent problems of the finance system playing out in the global economy. Are we asking why we need a medium of exchange for the purpose of trade, which is causing us to destroy each other and the environment? No, we don't. Are we actually demanding an urgently needed global reform of the so-holy enshrined and untouchable finance system? No, we are not. Overwhelmingly not. What I hear and read is demonstrating that all these measures, plans, packages, etc. are just euphemisms of more of the same old failed ideas, all hatched inside the thinking box. No one steps out of it. No one ever questions the system as such. Maybe that the system itself is the real problem of all problems, or am I wrong? So don't try to talk me back into the box. I'm tired of circular arguments, such as why you diminish your economy's ability to create jobs when you cut spending, but you can't increase your hired finance, or in popular jargon, you can't hire more, borrow more without severe additional hiring costs, imbalances of keeping the economy competitive, but then you must grow to survive, and so forth. Huh? It's silly, isn't it? Worming and twisting around inside the old box. So, what shall I say in all honesty about the US and Europe? Uncle Sam, what's wrong with you? Madam Europa, what are you doing? Let's ask Graham what his thoughts are. Oh, glad to see you, Graham. What are your thoughts about the woes in the US and Europe?
Well, that is a very big question because it involves trade. You know, we could look at it from all sorts of angles. Are we looking at it from the trader's point of view or the consumer's point of view? It makes a bit of difference. But in the end, it doesn't make any difference because all we're dealing with is what I call hired finance. You call it borrowed money.
We can refer to this in previous programs explaining that.
Yeah. Well, what I would believe to be the case there. You know, you ask what is going on there. Well, my thoughts about what is going on there is that you will forever, as you point out in your introduction, that, well, you're in the box and you will go round and round in the box forever. Breaking out of the box would entail a completely new concept and understanding of a monetary system. What sort of monetary system do you want? Do you want the sort of monetary system that actually demands that we exploit each other and so forth, as you've pointed out?
Mm.
And since it is a monetary system, I mean, it's obvious to me that they're just completely unaware that it's the monetary system as it stands, of creating money out of an asset and actually retiring the money back into the asset, which requires a constant, absolute constant round of, as you call them, borrowings or hirings. So,
which drives the cost of it higher?
Well, it's the cost is simple enough to explain, in as much as it's all hired money. You can break it up into profit and hired money, but it doesn't mean that it's different. It's only a form. Profit is only a form of hired money. It does not add 1 cent to the amount of money in circulation. Because we've got so much profit, it does not mean that we've added that profit to the amount of money in circulation. The consumer buys with profit, and that is the trader's profit. The circularity of it makes it very difficult to come to actually grasp what I've heard you refer to as an abstraction. Is all hired money, that is all the money there is, we understand that, it's all been hired, it's all...
That's the, how it's created.
All the money in the global economy is created.
Regardless what we call it later on.
Regardless. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's the money. And then to distinguish somebody's income, we have to use the word profit. You don't get an income from hiring money. That's what you'd call a
but
debt.
But that's what America and Europe thinks.
Yes.
That's the problem.
So it's really...
But they think they can do it.
Yeah. Well, if they
just
can...
Just coming back to the present woes in the media.
Well, to make a profit, they have to create more debt. Profit is not in any way profitable in a global economy. It is actually creating the need to hire more money.
Yeah.
More money that's hired, and it's ever growing, I think is the reason why we have to have expansion and contraction, but a contraction of scarcity in finance and growth in production and growth in profit. The cost is paid with more hired money in the form of profit. But this type of payment only adds to the ever-accumulating amount of unpaid fees on which other fees are added in a percent rate per annum basis. It's always out there, this hired money, but it has a per annum basis. So... annually, the amount must grow. Somebody has had to borrow or hire more money. So that is a cost. The costs ever grow. That's all I can contribute to, to your program there. I can only say that you hit the nail on the head when you talk about asset as the only money there is. The thing is that profit is scarce. Mm. And to allay the costs of production, you have to increase the amount of money. That is always out there as a hired product or as a borrowing or as a debt, doesn't matter what you call it, on which a percent per annum is levied. All I'm trying to point out is that levy then increases the cost of the next round of production.
Yeah.
And you increase the cost, you've got to produce more, sell more, and make more profit, or you can't even access what you've produced. You must have income.
Your attention, and hence all you have to do is mention the money. It's like sex, you got none you want, and now she's all up in your wallet for the money. So can I get a price check? Yeah, can I get a price check on your life and the side effects?
effects of the money, the greed, the debt, the schemes. Check one, two, check two, three, get a mind check.
Yeah, I'm sure that they are doing the right thing. It's the only thing they can do under the system. Yeah. You can either talk about the system as it stands, and if you're talking about the problems it causes, well, everything that can be done is being done to survive under the system. Yeah, yeah. It is self-perpetuating. It will go on forever. It will go on. It won't crash. There's no way. How can it crash?
Well, we don't even know, most of us, what it is.
Well, they don't even know what it is. There's nothing to crash.
All right, Graham, can we go to the specific dilemma?
Greece?
Yeah, the specific European dilemma.
Well, of course, if you look at the European common market as a unit, which it is, you could then think of the whole economy in Europe as being a domestic market. But within the domestic market, there are signs, as we've discussed in previous programs, that the domestic market cannot produce profit by itself. It must have export. There are signs that the European common market as a whole, as an entity, one entity, is not actually exporting enough to cover its overall costs. So the so-called bad apples in the barrel or whatever, Greece and Ireland, Portugal, whatever it is, more evidence, domestic market failure. All third world countries are just that. Domestic market failed economies because they don't have an export market to produce profit. You cannot make a profit within your community.
Yeah, because the cost outstrips the purchasing power.
The cost of production is always greater than the amount of money that you can put into circulation.
Yeah. We had a recent case in Australia, in the south, in Victoria. We had I saw a media feature on a Victorian orange farmer who produced beautiful oranges, the best since years, because he suffered drought in the past. And then he realized with our exchange rate, he has no chance to obtain a profit with export. No. And the consequence was that he had to dump the whole lot.
Yes, it's an unfortunate consequence of the present system within the domestic market. It's happened in the United States before, and it has happened in other countries where whole fields of grain, tons of grain, have corn, for instance, in the United States back in the 80s, was dumped or turned into ethanol that ran their tractors and tried to make a profit by not having to buy fuel for production. Because the cost of getting the corn to the market, the cost was greater than the price they were going to get for it.
Well, in this specific case, we have this high dollar. I have an idea. I mean, it's a little bit flippant, my idea.
Yeah.
If we wanted to get the currency value down to be more competitive in our exports and attract more tourists, tourism industry, kick-starting that again, how about printing the head of Karl Marx on the Australian dollar, just as a little statement, no comment?
Well, yes, I think that would really be something that
they would gonna go far from it. They would not want to touch this dollar any longer, no? And not drive it any higher.
I think he understood a different form of capitalism than the concept of capitalism today.
Yeah, so did Adam Smith, poor souls.
Yes, and many others.
All right, Graham. Let's wind it up with here. I've got some historical piece to follow here to wind up the listener. I mean, to lead the listeners out to a conclusion of the show.
I look forward to listening to that.
Mm. Thanks very much.
Through the summer of 1929, there had been ominous rumblings. For months, unemployment had been rising. Automobile sales and department store revenues had fallen off sharply. Across the South and West, farms were failing in record numbers. And still on Wall Street, The delirious optimism continued, undimmed. On August 27, 1929, the Dow Jones average reached its all-time peak as an army of frenzied buyers descended on New York. Desperate not to miss a single day's trading, swamping the hotels, camping out on the street in front of the stock exchange, and in the tiny graveyard of Trinity Church on Broadway. As summer turned to fall, the mood changed. As the stock market dipped, then rose, then lurched downwards again, investors grew increasingly uneasy. In September, an economist named Roger Babson sent a wave of fear rippling through Wall Street when he warned that sooner or later, a crash is coming, and it may be terrific. But most experts brushed away any concerns. Stock prices, one man declared, have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. And then the bottom fell out. On Wednesday, October 23rd, 1929, the first waves of panicky selling began to drive down the price of blue chip stocks, like Westinghouse and General Electric. The following morning, the fear turned to panic, and brokers began unloading margin accounts at record speed. Stock prices plummeted sickeningly across the board, spurring the rush of sell orders from terrified speculators still more. As anguished shrieks rose up from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the visitors' gallery was clear. In less than 2 hours, nearly $10 billion invested in stocks was simply wiped out. The following Tuesday, October 29th, 1929, known forever after as Black Tuesday, another tidal wave of selling hit the exchange. Hour after hour, the market continued its descent into chaos and pandemonium as stock prices simply collapsed under the torrent of panicked selling. And desperate brokers fought and screamed and trampled one another to get out. In the worst single day in the history of the New York Stock Exchange, the market lost $14 billion in value, bringing the week's loss to more than $30 billion, 10 times more than the entire annual budget of the federal government, and far more than the United States had spent during all of World War I. Worst hit in the short run were the thousands of small investors who, believing that everyone could be rich, had bought stock on margin, sometimes borrowing as much as 90% of its book value. In a matter of hours, in some cases minutes, they had lost everything. Their life savings, their houses, and their dreams. The present week, one newspaper editor declared, has witnessed the greatest stock market catastrophe of all times. It would take a decade and a half for the American economy to fully recover.
I think the reason the crash lives on in the American folk memory, although there aren't many people alive today who were adults when the crash happened in almost 70 years ago now, but what followed the crash, the Great Depression, which permanently scarred the American psyche. And we remember the crash as the beginning of the Great Depression, although in fact the two had nothing to do with each other, or very little. But that's why I think the crash became such a benchmark, because it was this very sharp line between the prosperity and the giddy cocktail party of the 1920s and the awful depression of the 1930s and the bread lines and the apple cellars and the bonus riots and what have you.
I can only cry out that I have lost my splendid mirage. Come back, come back, oh glittering and white. F. Scott Fitzgerald.
out a mile, stuck my neck out a mile for the President of the United States. I stuck my neck out a mile. It's on the table. But a lot of people in this town say, stuck my neck out a mile.
Thanks for listening. This show and other shows are available by visiting kaputradio.libsyn.com or search for Kaput Radio's podcast.
kaputradio.libsyn.com.
My name is Martin, and I share this sentiment of Mitch Ben for the coming episode, so catch you then. Bye.
These are the other things in the news right now. They're the other things in the news right now. We're obsessed with the phone hacking scandal and how, but there are other things in the news right now.